So, good morning. We begin this panel with the speech of Leonardo Marcato, which is PhD student and works in with me in the University of Venice. He will defend his thesis on Panikkar in February of the next year. He studies the religious and philosophical roots of Panikkar's thought, and his speech is titled The Mystic Logomythical Knowledge, a Possible Approach to the Contemporary World.
Okay. First of all, I am very excited to be here today in front of so many scholars and friends of Raymond Panikkar. Master to some, friend for many, whom a lot of you knew in person, studied and talked with him. I admit that I am in awe, even intimidated, in front of such a group of Panikkar's friends. And I am very anxious that what will I say might find some interest and might be found, if a word like this can be used, from a theoretical and dialogical point of view, coherent in Panikkar's vision. I never met him. All I know about him is based on his works, books, interviews, papers, and stories heard from those who knew him. And this is a focal point, I think, when approaching Panikkar and his thought without having met him. For the value of dialogue, of face-to-face, or better, soul-to-soul meeting and discussing is paramount. Can a book, an interview, a paper transmit the same strength that he gave when he was alive? Can a scholar like me, who never met him, really understand what he said? The mythos he spoke, the logos he wrote. I think that for every philosopher, for every master, a real understanding can come only by an answer to a direct question, but not in the term of the mere exchange and the meaning of the words that such a master may use, but how his wholeness can say and how the questioner listens to the answer. The way of approaching a thinker's work is in the key to understanding him. And this is how I try to approach Panikkar and his writings, by allowing myself to listen to his works as symbols, as he meant the word. I assume that this consensus of scholar knows very well what symbol, logos, and mythos mean in Raymond Panikkar's thought. Thus, I won't go in deep in order to explain them and use the short time available for the theme's purpose. I first met Panikkar during my bachelor, thanks to a paper he wrote for Simplegadi, Rivista di Filosofia Interculturale, about homeomorphic equivalences. From there, I started to read more and more of him, drawing a comparison between his cosmotheandric vision and Nishida Kitaro's inverse correlation in my master thesis. Now, in my PhD, I focus only on his work, with particular interest in the dialogical dialogue. In studying and reading, I came across two main themes that constantly returns in Panikkar's talk. The critique to Parmenides' dogma, think and being is the same, and the logomythic dynamis. My presentation today is about this latter notion. If we want to have some chronological coordinates, this concept emerged for the first time in 1961 in his early paper La Delimitologizzazione nell'incontro del Cristianesimo con l'Induismo, which translates to The Demitologization in the Meeting of Christianism and Hinduism, that he wrote after his first trip in India and during his second staying in Rome. It is a work on the boundaries between evangelization and comparative philosophy of religion, but what's astonishing is that already in this early stage, the logomythic dynamis is carved out, even if some details were still in development. I quote, "We can even say that the unity between event and parabole allegory, between logos and mythos, so in this meaning, a true and proper logomythic synthesis, we won't dare use the expression mythology, happens with the true participation of that thing, with the true welcoming of that person, the true representation of that event and genuine acceptance of that parabole, and this is the ritual. End of quotation. And shortly thereafter, I quote, "For those who live in the aura of a logos-centered culture, the parabole connects logos to mythos, helping to discover a pure logos inadequacy, an inadequacy of the pure logos, and guides to the other side of the river, where concepts are not merely adored, where they are revealed as simply means conditioned by a determined culture without being forced to abandon them, where reality is no more conceptualized, scissored, elaborated, but grasped, lived, experienced, where reality itself flows, proceeds, and lives through the subject. Myths do not make us contemplate reality, but pump us in reality, and, paradoxically, let us be part of it, conscious not of ourselves, but of the wholeness of reality. Here, the logos is not negated, but integrated." End of quotation. This logomythic dynamic's first occurrence, here still called synthesis, as we all know, a proper formulation appears later in Myth, Faiths, and Hermeneutics, and we can consider the final formulation now published in Opera Omnia's ninth volume, Mystery and Hermeneutics, as definitive. The key to the dialogical dialogue, I believe, is the consciousness of this mystic dynamis, and this is the reason I started to study it, even from a philological point of view, for as far as in its production as I could. Without this knowledge of the constitutive interrelation between mythos and logos, knowledge that is an inclination, a disposition, a mystical way of life, a proper understanding of the other is difficult. But I believe that this dynamis can go further and farther, and its strength can be crucial in understanding the liquid contemporarity. Even from a semantic point of view, if I can indulge in an exercise of Panikkarian semantic philosophy, this is clearly cut out. Dynamis is movement, but also power to change, ability to evolve. When Galileo discovered the stars, if you let me the poetry, he used this logos to unveil his time's mythos. And in doing so, he created a new mythos, where the logos was nevertheless recognized in its power. And with this mythos, we went to the moon, and human is now in space. I believe that a quote from late Sir Terry Pratchett can be properly used in this context. In the novel Hogfather, when asked what happened if the sun god wasn't saved, the character Death answered, "The sun would not have risen. A mere ball of flaming gas would have illuminated the world." Being aware of the logomythic dynamis does not mean changing reality as it is, because a change assumes stasis, but being, we are reminded, is a rhythm, impossibly to be fully grasped and described, and here is Panica's critic to Parmenides. It really changes in our inclination as subjects, in our acknowledgement of the other and its mythos. And from here, as I said, rises the dialogical dialogue. "Our is a logos-centered culture," says Panikkar, "where the logos itself has not turned into mythos, but took the role of mythos. Logos deconstructs mythos, allowing a new remitization, but the contemporary logos does not allow a remitization and poses itself as the new, monolithic and monist Western truth made of science, technology, false democracy, and profit." Or is it? I think, and here I try to move forward by being faithful to Panikkar, that even in our contemporarity, in our Western contemporaneity, a new Western logos is rising to challenge what is now the mythos of science and technology. Logomythic dynamis is natural, is part of the human path in this world, and involves all the aspects where we live. It is established in the anthropic dimension of the rhythm of being. And the characteristic of this new logos can't be described yet, but we can try to pinpoint some characteristic of it, thanks to Panikkar, in at least three dimensions: scientific, politic, and social. The scientific point of view is the simplest to explain, and what I think may be broadly acknowledged. It has been years since quantum mechanics, string theory, and similia showed how the interrelation, interindependence, and autonomy of reality from a strict scientific point of view is possible, as Panikkar meant them. This is challenging the sectorialized logos of science thanks to an equally rational logos that is starting to abrade the pedestal of Western science mythos. The road is still long, but I believe we'll see the results soon in an harmonic autonomy scientific view of reality, which takes into the account the anthropological and metaphysical alongside the scientific. The political point of view is a bit more challenging. I believe the mythos of Western democracy, which is very far from its ideal and concept, is being unveiled from different logos and positions, all of them equally rational inside the mythos, obviously. The rise of megacorporation, just think at how Disney is buying all Western entertainment brands, or how Google's acquiring robotic laboratories, is starting to control the lives of employers regardless of state boundaries. But there are other forms of logos which challenges traditional politic mythos in different ways. Since Pierre Lévy's publication of Collective Intelligence, for example, more or less organized political movements advocate some form of direct democracy thanks to the web. And as we were reminded before, a theocratic dictatorship is on the rise in the Middle East. All of them justified by their logos, all of them trying to unveil the Western mythos. It's impossible to say which one will establish itself at this time in our contemporarity. We can't make provision. We can only analyze what's present to us. But it will probably depend on the outcome of the social point of view. This third dimension, where logomythic dynamics can help in understanding Western contemporarity, is how relation between humans is evolving. And here is that dialogical dialogue can start in this new millennium. The problem here is that it's hard to find the mythos that drives the human. What does it mean to be human nowadays? Let me explain. Panikkar says that we have lost ourselves inside identifications with our role, our family, our work, and that we need to recover the sense of wholeness of reality fragmented by the vastness of opposing monisms. But with such a different number of cultures, of identities lost in their identification, in the Western and Westernized world, which one is the common foreground? Is there a common mythos? Here I try to present an interpretation according to Panikkar. As Panikkar would have said, but what I will try to say by following Panikkar. Because the new technologies, I reckon, are in some way responsible of this fragmentation and for a certain stasis in our modern lives. And thus we can say that the hyper-rationalization of society based on science gives is another example of the logos-centered culture. But in these very new technologies, I believe we can see the seeds, not only for us to reconnect the fragment and integrating the logos in the mythos, and look with critical eyes at our politics, economies, and social status. The risk of hoaxes is terribly high, as a good number of academic studies has shown in the past years. But fact-checking can help prevent that, and fact-checking is logos work in its most rational power. Furthermore, thanks to the digital, we are closer to transcend space and time transcendentalia in a tempiternar conception. And on a side note, I suggest to read Panikkar's fifth sutra of Disciples Canon, now in Opera Omnia, second tome of the first volume, by keeping in mind the speed of the internet. Socially then, I think, it is hard to separate mythos and logos, because what keeps us inside the logocentric culture can also, if used healthily, free us and help us out. All of human knowledge is potentially available to us. And with this, we can expand in real time the knowledge of the other with whom we are in dialogue without forgetting that we are in dialogue. I stress healthy because it is too easy to get lost in this fathom and to turn into one of the too many angry users of the web. But the social chance that it gives us is that digitally we can see the logomythic dynamics work in both ways. To quote from the mirror metaphor, we are able to see both our and others' glasses and rationally dialogue with acknowledgement of the assumption. On a larger scale, which takes into account society as a whole, a good comparison might be with what emerges from a Derrida-like deconstructive approach to contemporarity. But the difference here is that we're involved with our entire selves. Logomythic dynamis fuel expresses itself during a dialogue that is not a jacuzzi, not a merely inquire. And nowadays, the digital have the potential to be dialogical in a panicarian way and help our way of life. It is almost utopian, I admit, but it is not a good excuse to avoid to approach contemporarity, even in what looks most technology, as techne, which is artistic and instrumental autonomic expression of the human spirit. Every technology during the ages has been accused of dehumanizing, in brackets, ourselves, only to be later on rationally analyzed and integrated in our way of lives. From the spyglass to the Hubble telescope, from the press to television, they are all examples, if read through the existential and mythic approach gifted by logomythic dynamis, of chance for the human to acknowledge the fullness of life. Most of them wasted, and with terrible damages to ourselves and to the environment, but other, a few, fruitful. Science has an autonomy, and so does the digital. Even more, now that's tied with what we are, with a strength inferior only to those of the medical science, and opens new chances, new pathways, and new riches for a fruitful dialogical dialogue that can potentially be between all humankind without limit of time, without limit of space, and in a constant interrelation. In conclusion, I hope that what I said in this presentation of mine was interesting to you and in accord with Panica's spirit. I never met him, as I said during the introduction, and this is sad for me, but I tried to accept his own invitation in Opera Omnia's foreword to listen and to dialogue with his writings. His words, his insights, are still sound to the ear that allows itself to be challenged by his vision. And as I try to present, they are a precious point of view when approaching every aspect of the human, even more now that the times are changing so fast that technology risks to lose its last bit of humanity. In the challenge between transhumanism and posthumanism, Panica's thought, I believe, can be herald of a new humanism, which is harmonic view of reality and ourselves. I believe that he still has a lot to say in every time period, for he was a thinker and a master. Thank you.
To you, my, as the Germans say, Mitbruder Xavier Taramel, a Jesuit priest from Kerala studying in England at the University of Birmingham, is doing his PhD there, on Panica's religious pluralism and its implications in the theology of religion. Great people have a special type of handwriting. Xavier argues that Panica's pluralism is relational and it does not have a center. When other theologians move around a center, real and God, Panica moves around a centerless center because in his approach, everything becomes the center.
So thank you very much, Father Francis, for presenting me to this wonderful audience. And let me begin with this, with recording my gratitude to Milena and Terry and Francis, Father Francis Amaldas, and all of my gurus, and also Raymond, who helped me to, you know, come over, and Renate, who helped me with the processing of visa and so on, made me possible to present this. Let me begin with a very familiar quotation from you know, Scott Estam, who is a very familiar figure. Introduction. It's an introduction in the Cosmotheantic Experience, Emerging Religious Consciousness by Raymond Panikkar. So it is all a circle dance. So three circles interweaving, people from distant lands holding hands, discovering each other as they learn how to dance together. So not one circle, or two circles, three could mean many circles. And everyone would dance his own, her own way. And during the dance, one would try to learn from the other. For example, I see somebody dancing there, and it has got a wonderful, you know, step, and then I learn from that. And I dance according to that. And the rhythm is a rhythm of being. So therefore, anybody can dance. Everyone is welcome to dance. And what does it mean? I started as a Christian, and I discovered I was a Hindu, and I returned as a Buddhist without ever having ceased to be a Christian. So perhaps what I see in this autobiographical statement, this wonderful circle dance, a dance in which Raymond would learn from the other and then becoming that. It's not identifying, but you know, finding the identity of his own life. So Raymond Panikkar is generally considered as a theologian advocating pluralism, which makes an entirely new approach in the theology of religions. So, as we know, Panikkar's birth itself as a child of an Indian Hindu father. I come from Panikkar's fatherland, Kerala, a beautiful place. And a Spanish Roman Catholic mother suggests his multi-religious context that itself, you know, suggests. And Panikkar's attitude and the methodological stance on the issue of religious pluralism are famously expressed in his autobiographical statement, which I pointed out. What does it mean to be a Christian, a Hindu, and a Buddhist simultaneously? So let me go to England. Is John Hick, a famous you know, philosopher, theologian. Religious pluralism means, according to Hick, various responses to the real, he would not use God, through different human concepts, images, and experiences of the same. And then he quotes the 13th century wonderful Persian mystic poet Jalaluddin Rumi, telling that the lamps are different, but the light is the same. And it is quoted from his book, An Interpretation of Religion, Human Responses, page 233. And there is another guy in the state, United States, Marcus Haim. You may be familiar with, some of you may be familiar with him. Mark, he suggests that different religions have different ends or goals in God. Unlike Hick, Haim works from the Christian Trinitarian God concept, God as the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and his approach implies neither liberal nor conservative characteristics, but an affirmation of the possibility of religious diversity and diverse religious ends. While Hick's approach is not limited to any particular religious tradition, hymns approach includes both biblical and historical Christian traditions, which limits the scope of his pluralistic thinking. The book on Trinity and Religious Pluralism, The Doctrine of the Trinity in Christian Theology of Religions by Velimati Karkanian. And something from India, I tried to understand him, not much familiar with him, Stanley Samartha. He adopts a dialogical method in order to address the question of religious pluralism, which is quite similar to Panikkar's approach. Although Samartha argued for a theocentric engagement, akin to John Hick, he does not reject or wish to reinterpret the Christian doctrine to accommodate other religions. So there's a famous quotation, to acknowledge the fact of religious pluralism means that one cannot take shelter in a neutral or objective ground. There is no theological helicopter that can help us to rise above all religions and look down. Our standpoint has to be Christian, but by same token, our neighbors are also free to have the particular standpoints. Okay. That's from his book, Courage for Dialogue, page number 40. And now, there is a Gerald James Larson in Dr. Joseph Prabhu's wonderful book, that Intercultural Challenge of Raymond Panikkar. He's telling that Panikkar has succeeded in constructing a formulation of the notion of pluralism that is conceptually tight, reasonably consistent, properly differentiated from other position. However, at the end of the article, he's telling, however, Larson strangely concludes that Panikkarian theoretical pluralism breaks down on the basis of multi-valued judgments. Yesterday, I was happy to listen to Dr. Lugi. Who spoke about this, you know, logical structures, and I should learn that more. And now, Panikkar's pluralistic approach is mystical and rooted in the inner dynamism of the Trinitarian God, because the Trinitarian life symbolizes plurality in oneness or unity in diversity. This is Lancetta, the same book. Although Paul Nitter observes that the fundamental basis of Panikkar's theology of religions is a personal mystical experience, Nitter's earlier article titled Cosmic Confidence on or Preferential Option suggests that Panikkar is a radical pluralist. And also, my guru, Dr. Francis D'Souza, one of the renowned experts on Panikkar, has suggested that Panikkar is a relational pluralist, as the ground of his pluralistic theology is an organic interconnectedness. And that is in his article in Jivadhara. So, the fundamental structure of Panikkar's theology is relationality, which he draws from Advaita. So we'll skip some of those. And the question raised in Shankara's Advaita Vedanta is how the eternal is related to temporal. So very simplifying all those things. According to Panikkar, the world is real only in relationship with God and human beings, and vice versa. Every existence is possible only with interrelatedness. Panikkar further expounds this aspect of interrelatedness. We have that quotation, between them, heaven and earth support all other beings, and their tension is relational, so that one cannot be without the other. There is no earth without heaven, and heaven would be devoid of meaning if it were not perpetuated by the dwellers on earth. There is no God without man and the world. There is no man without God and the world. There is no world without God and man. So this relational ontology is the foundation of Panikkar's Advaita. For that reason, I call this thought relational Advaita. In the light of Panika's relational Advaita, pluralism has to be seen as a state of inescapable relationship of multiplicities. According to him, the very nature of the truth is pluralistic, but not plural. So this is the a few points I am making. The wonderful metaphor, I'm trying to by heart, it's wonderful. The rivers of the earth do not actually meet each other. It's from quoted from the Jordan, Tiber, and the Ganges. And page number 92. The rivers of the earth do not actually meet each other on, not even in the oceans, nor do they need to meet in order to be truly life-giving rivers, but they do meet. They meet in the skies, that is, in heaven. The rivers do not meet, not even as water. They meet in the form of clouds, once they have suffered transformation into vapor, which eventually will pour down again into the valleys of mortals to feed the river of the earth. My metaphor does not stand for a transcendent unity of all religions in an unqualified way. This is wonderful. So therefore, and the relevance of Panika's relational pluralism, pluralistic vision. The question of pluralism emerges not as an impasse presented by religions or cultures, etc. It is a compelling question that emerges in the presence of the other. To engage, to understand, to live within differences. So differences engender conflicts within the diverse context. Often the question of pluralism is raised to tackle differences and to peacefully coexist or to seek out survival. As UNESCO's preamble speaks about the peace, the war begins from the minds of the men. It is in the minds of the men the defense of the peace must be constructed. So, as we had a wonderful session on that peace. However, I think the issue is to discover the differences themselves. So, therefore, the pluralism becomes a problem when the effort is taken to have a peaceful coexistence or survival, but not to discover the differences as such. Certainly, isolation is not possible in today's world. Thus, the issue of pluralism has been everyday experience rather than intellectual exercise. If the other is a problem, then that has to be resolved to ensure world survival. Hence, the next question for us is about tolerance, a term much used and abused in a multi-religious context. Therefore, what we need, if tolerance indicates broad-mindedness or open-mindedness, then it is a term implying a conflicting situation. However, I think it is not an appropriate expression in a multi-religious context, as it always implies survival. When tolerance becomes an ideology, one is forced to tolerate what it cannot yet extirpate. So, what Panikkar is saying, pluralism is a fundamental human attitude. It's a fundamental human attitude. In his self-critical dialogue in Joseph Prabhu's book, it's a wonderful phrase I always try to remember, the fundamental human attitude of recognizing the presence of the other. So, in conclusion, I would say Panikkar treats pluralism as an essential human attitude rather than a theory. When Hick, Haim, and Samatha construct or uphold their respective pluralistic stance by placing an absolute, a center, a God, a real or Trinity, Panikkar's pluralism operates without a center, while every reality emerges as a center in his approach. So everywhere there is a center. Here, pluralism is a relationship between irreducible differences, thus it does not need to revolve around an isolated center. In other words, Panikarian pluralism is relationship in operation. So there is a quote from Cosmotheantric Experience, page number 77. The cosmotheantric intuition does not gravitate around a single point, neither God nor man nor world. And in this essence, it has no center. This is why I think that Panikkar's pluralistic yarn is unique within the pluralistic theology of religions. Here, a man comes out with his honorary doctorate and is going behind the scene, moving to the mythos of our life. And thank you very much.
I'm introducing is Dr. Renate Kern. I think she's a German, I take it, because she's studying in Munich at the prestigious College of the Jesuits. I say prestigious because there's a philosophical faculty of the university which is almost empty in Munich. And the students are flocking at this Pollack faculty of the Jesuits, where I had a very, what shall I say, almost a violent session there. I am also a Jesuit because I spoke on the notion of history built on Panikkar, and Jesuits are not very happy with Panikkar, also with me talking about Panikkar. But Renate is lucky to find a Jesuit who is open to Panikkar. That's good news indeed. And Renate has taken as her theme from about Panikkar, from Christology to Christophany. What she's presenting here is not a sketch of a doctorate thesis, but just a part of it. She's giving a sort of aperitif. So in the short time that is available to her, she's showing how she intends to go about it, and this is a tentative thing.
Two words before I start. Firstly, I'm very thankful for being here in the symposium. And secondly, yes. And secondly, my first theological love many years before Raimund Panikkar appeared in my horizon was the German theologian Karl Rahner. Even some Germans told me to read Karl Rahner in the English translation because it's easier. But I enjoyed reading Rahner in German, and so my English remained sleeping all these years. So please bear with me. And you can read some words. The topic of my doctoral thesis is Christophany, Raimund Panikkar's transformation of Christology in an interreligious and intercultural perspective. But as you already heard, today, now, I'm not going to present a summarized outline of my thesis. Instead, I have elected a very small part concerning the development of his Christology. Over the next 15 minutes, I'm going to compare only two essays of Panikkar. Panikkar's first paper, which was published in German in 1952, and his late and his last paper published in German in 2008. I will compare them in order to shed light on the continuity and changes in his Christological thinking. Part one. A provocation to start with. Are the Catholics Catholic? The title of this early essay reminds us of the ambiguity of the term Catholic. Indeed, as the subtitle Corpus Christi and its members suggests, what Panikkar has in mind is not the Roman Catholic denomination, but the original meaning of the word, universal or all-encompassing. Panikkar does not intend to examine modern Catholics' orthodoxy, but rather asks to what extent Catholicism has actually realized its call to universality. How far has Catholicism come to be truly holistic, truly ecumenical? According to Panikkar's sharp-witted analysis, Roman Catholics don't fulfill this task at all. His paper is an urgent and passionate call for a thorough examination of conscience and metanoia. An assessment of the current situation. Panikkar diagnoses the Catholics with a weakness of Catholicity, which leads to their being divided in manifold aspects. The first division is the disunity of the church itself. Secondly, this inner conflict increases the Catholics' tendency to distance themselves from the so-called outer world. The tendency, I quote, to shut out everything which does not belong to our ghetto, though given life to dwell on earth by God, creator of the very sun that shines upon good and evil. A third manifestation of splitting is a form of disintegration of everyday life. Many Catholics distinguish between being human and being Christian. Panikkar refers to this situation as degenerated Christianity. Yet he considers it to be an expression of change, of a period of transition leading to a new era. This requires conversion and renewal. Catholic universality does not present a merely intellectual problem, so Catholics have to answer the call to Catholicity with their individual lives. The task of theologians is to support this quest by developing a Christocentric ontology. In order to make the revelation an integral part of our thinking, that we may learn, I quote, not only to act in a Christian manner, but also to think in a truly Catholic way. Christ as foundation and cause of universality. Panikkar's paper contains approaches to a Christocentric ontology. The beginning and end of a true Catholicity is Jesus Christ. Speaking in Paulinian terms, the Christian is a new creation in him. This high standard is supposed to be valid for any aspect of human life, and, from a Christian perspective, it commands a Catholic disposition towards other humans, since the ontic human communion in Christ forms the, I quote, center and common ground of all human beings. Christ is the basis and cause of an encompassing unity. He is the ontic mediator in all directions. He mediates between man and himself, between man and God, and between man and his fellow human beings and the world around. Catholic universality is based on the universality of Christ, and hence the Christian perspective is always all-encompassing. Panica refers to the risen Christ, not to the historical Jesus, to a Christology from above. How far does Panica's universality reach in 1952? In his essay, Panica's understanding of the term church remains vague. Occasionally, he seems to identify the church with the institutional Roman Catholic Church. However, his intention obviously is to extend the church to all human beings. This ambiguity can be traced back to the fact that Panica does not always explicitly distinguish between institution and mystical body of Christ. For the latter, he seems to assume various possible forms of belonging, thus anticipating the view of the Second Vatican Council. And, please pay a special attention to this, according to Panica, a Catholic who denies being bonded with non-Christians excludes himself from the Eucharistic community. In this early paper, it becomes all the more clear that Panica's understanding of Catholicity and universality implicates a challenge for the Catholics themselves, but not at all the Church's demands on the world. At the same time, his thinking mediates in a dynamic fashion between Orthodox theory and new approaches. His fundamental concern is directed at creating unity. Part 2, the grand finale, Jesus Christ in Global Religious Dialogue. This paper, published in 2008, was based on a presentation Panica gave in 2004 when he was awarded the honorary doctorate of the Catholic Theological Faculty of the University of Tübingen. The title might suggest that the essay deals with Jesus Christ as reflected in other world religions. Instead, Panica challenges traditional Christology by asking questions from the perspective of different religious cultural backgrounds, and thus attempts to widen the usual Western Christian perspective on theology towards a global religious dialogue. A quest and a twofold challenge. Panica's main concern is to adopt a new approach towards the universality of Christ in order to pioneer a genuinely Catholic form of belief. This requires, I quote, Christianity to be liberated from an exclusive attachment to a particular history, the European history, in order to associate itself with the traditions of mankind at large, as symbolized in God's covenant with Noah. This venture is encouraged by the Holy Spirit, who roams freely and makes all things new. However, it requires a process of metanoia and a radical conversion of thinking, which is characterized by an appreciation of the plurality of cultures and religions. Two distinct yet interconnected challenges are implicated here. Firstly, negotiating the boundaries of common rationality, that is, unlocking the gates of European thinking, giving access especially to those mindsets from the Far East. And secondly, to transcend mere rationality, that is, surpassing a fixation with rational thought and doctrine, and leading to an intensified integration of individual experience and mysticism. In this paper, as in many of his writings, Panica emphasizes the need for a third eye. Mysticism must be an essential part of theology. Panica does not contest the Christian claim to universality, Yet he speaks up for interpreting the term in a completely different light, since, as he says, Christ is not the symbol of just one specific culture. It is the universality of Christ which enables and indeed commands us to move beyond the historical and cultural limitations of Christian tradition and consequently to overcome the bias of a mere rational approach to reality. An interpretation of the Creed. Jesus Christ is the Son of God. For Panika, this phrase can sum up the Christian creed. When attempting to interpret the meaning in a truly Catholic manner, each single word presents a problem. Panika demonstrates this by scrutinizing the meaning of the words one by one. As my time is limited, I can just quote some selected postulates. Jesus is Christ, but Christ does not coincide with Jesus. Christ is singular, yet not an individual. Jesus Christ, being the Son of God, identifies the Father as his origin. This means God is relationship, incorporating the entire creation, man and world, called by Panika radical Trinity. The cosmotheandric experience makes it perceptible. The connectedness of God, world, and man. A short comparison. Panika's message has remained the same for more than 5 decades. He advocates a renewal of Christianity. Both papers are a passionate call for metanoia, for a conversion aiming at a genuine Catholic universality. Apart from his appealing to every Christian, Panika's early paper seeks to Christianize the Catholic's thinking through a Christocentric ontology. At a later stage, he focuses on the necessity of transcending pure rationality and insisting on the importance of mysticism. In both papers, Panika creates a general atmosphere of striving for universality. This is based upon his belief in the unity of reality. Whilst initially he defended the case for unity from an ontological and Christocentric point of view, he eventually adds a pneumatological and Trinitarian perspective. This leads him to a differentiation of unity, taking account of the concept of cosmotheandric intuition, which may be approached through the school of thought of Advaita or from a Trinitarian point of view. Now, considering different cultures and religions, the Christocentric focus of his first paper has widened to embrace a Trinitarian theology, which Gotthard Fuchs calls a remarkable draft of interreligious pneumatology. One can hardly imagine Panika wrote in 1952 that humankind is inevitably progressing towards a unitary culture. Needless to say that both papers also provide evidence for changes in Panika's position towards the theology of religions. Conclusion. Taking into account that over a period of 6 decades, Panika has published nearly 50 books and more than 500 academic articles, selecting just 2 papers for a comparative review is more than daring. They are exemplary excerpts to provide us with a preliminary approach to this impressive opus. They are flashes. Yet, they demonstrate in a fascinating way how the main hubs can be spotted in the universe of Panika's thought, covering centuries, distant cultures and religions, science and mysticism. Thank you for your attention.
I'm so glad to introduce Charlotte Sunde, who flew in from New Zealand. She studied her PhD 10 years ago under the supervision of Dr. Scott Eastman, who in turn was a student of Professor Panikkar and a close collaborator and editor of Panikkar's work in English. Charlotte's thesis was titled The Water or the Wave? Toward the cross-cultural ecology of understanding for environmental practice. She works at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. She wasn't in the program, but because we were thinking of, well, she is still very young, but we left
aging by the second.
She was the youngest scholar, youngest scholar invited to three seminars, very important one, international seminar. One was in Mumbai, the other was in Seoul, and the third was in Brisbane.
And Venice.
And in Venice as well. Yeah. So she couldn't but come. Yes. Please say something.
Thank you, Milena. I've decided to stand because I'm a kinesthetic person and I need to move. So I'm very grateful to Milena Carrara for inviting me to this important occasion to commemorate Raymond Panikkar and to return to his mountain home in Te Avetet, and also to witness the gifting of his books. As he told me, half a kilometer of books. So I suppose he got quite fit walking up and down his personal library. So I have travelled from the exact Antipodean polarity on the planet. If you dig a hole right through the planet, although it'll get rather warm, you can reach my home. And I've returned to Te Avetet, and I've experienced again the generous Catalan hospitality. So thank you very much to the hosts of the symposium. It's heartening for me to be back amongst the scholars and friends of Panikkar and to reaffirm my personal friendships with you and also to embrace new friendships. So as Milena pointed out, I consider myself part of a second generation of students of Panikkar. And I have been luckier than some of you to have met Raymond on two occasions. One, the first time when Roger Rapp took me up to Te Avetet to meet with Raymond and meet him personally, and I now realise such a privilege that was, a sort of pilgrimage for me. I had just finished my PhD, and the second was to celebrate his 90th birthday in Venice, and I was there. At the time, I was doing my postdoctorate in Paris, and so I had the occasion to meet up again with Scott and many of you here today. And that was a splendid conference, and to see again Carmen was just stunning. So, and as Milena's pointed out, I've had sort of 10 years of nourishment at these Panikkar conferences, where I've listened very carefully to your words, to your reflections, your deep contemplation, your intellectual knowledge about Panikkar's works, and I've absorbed those over time. So maybe my time will come, I think, because the shock of losing Scott has made me realise that we can't take for granted that
these occasions will always these occasions always take place. So the responsibility of our generation is to engage with Panaka, I think, beyond the works of Panaka, but to know him. And as Yung Chan pointed out at the beginning, who am I? Well, I am through you. I know myself through you. And each of you connect with Panaka. So when I look out here, I see Panaka in each of you and in myself. And so the message for me is, and to my generation, second generation of the students of Panaka, is not to turn Panaka into a Panakarology. It's not to study Panaka in and of himself, but to take the messages and the extremely important messages that he has conveyed through his vast intellect and the depth of his grasp of that, theological and philosophical, and actually to do something with it. And I think that is something that Scott has always said to me, that there's this need to do to have a practical Panaka. And by that, I don't mean to belittle the theological and the philosophical depth that we need to go in, but the responsibility is to do something with it. And each of us express that through our different interests and our different inclinations and our different strengths. So when we come together, it's a richness, because we all come together from different takes on that. I want to just quickly acknowledge Scott, because he died the 4th of October 2013, and it was a huge shock. And I know that the next month you had the Baltimore symposium, where there were many acknowledgements, but I wasn't there, so it's my occasion now, I think, to formally say something. I just want to say that he was an editor of a number of Panaka's published works in English, including the Cosmotheandric Experience. So thank you very much for your quote there, and for reminding us. And that's particularly a good quote, the one about the dance, because when you know Scott, he was light on his feet, and he was, as when he got excited about something, he leapt around, you know. You knew he was inspired, because he was inspired with his full body. I also just want to say that Scott sat at the back of the hall, the packed lecture halls in Edinburgh, with a little audio cassette, and he made recordings of each of those lectures that Scott gave at the most prestigious Gifford Lecture Series. And then he transcribed those 10 lectures, and then he went and he worked diligently alongside Raymond, and he developed the earliest draft. So he moved up to Tavertet for a period of time with his young family, and they completed about 75% of what then was published as a Rhythm of Being. So I really do want to acknowledge that huge piece of work that he did there. It was a task of refining numerous drafts, and it's what I would summarise as an endurance test in editorial relationships, which lasted the best part of two decades. So the Rhythm of Being, the Unbroken Trinity, that much anticipated volume in English, was, in the English-speaking world, was fittingly dedicated to Scott Eastham. So just a little bit, I'm not going to give a treatise on my PhD, but what I want to do actually is give a little bit of a background for how I, as an environmental planning student who kind of embraced the environmental sciences and the social sciences, how I came to be open and receptive to Raymond Panaka, because I haven't come from the same philosophical and theological background as these students, very able in their critiques of Panaka. Mine was, and remains, I suppose, a very cosmotheandric relationship that I have with Panaker's work, although the foundation of my thesis was monism, dualism, and non-dualism, and that gave me a completely different take on the world that I had been dealing with, which was indigenous peoples and their relationship with the environment, and then the governments through different kind of conservation departments and their take on the environment. So I had been working with both cultures, and when I talk about indigenous peoples in our country, in New Zealand, they are very present, they are very active, they are not secluded to reservations or seen as something of the past, but they are actively present in shaping our culture in New Zealand. So I remember Scott saying that we were very privileged in New Zealand and very fortunate to have a very active indigenous culture. And for me, they are my other. They are the ones that challenged me and made me stop and think about my culture and the presumptions that I have about about the environment, for example, or about how we relate to each other. And they have the spaces for dialogue, and they retain those spaces for dialogue. You know, the physical places, but the rituals for it. And so my challenge is what my culture can we rise up, can us as the Western European New Zealanders, can we take on the challenge and actually have that dialogue with an indigenous culture who still live the cosmotheandric experience, not as a theory, but as a daily practice. So in a sense, that's what my thesis did to me. It became a full circle where I came back to thinking, critiquing my own culture because I had some experiences in others. So just in saying that, I want to pick up what Yung Chan said at the very beginning of the conference, where he said, "Who am I? I can only know me through you because you are the mirror of me." And the river that I came from and that I have spoken about before at other Panaka conferences, and the reason I keep going back to the river is not because I'm obsessed with this one river, but that river represents all rivers in the world, and in that case all of the earth. But the Māori continue to say of that river, say, ko au te awa, ko te awa ko au. And for them that is, I am the river and the river is me. So to me, that is the extension of what Yung Chan was saying, that you carry in the heart of us the other. What I carry, you carry that river, carry the earth in the heart of us. And then we are not saving, but we are serving, because in the act of serving, we are also saving. And we're saving ourselves. Just quickly, the title of my thesis, The Water or the Wave, it came from a Latin quote, which I can't remember off the top of my head, but the reason why I've said that, in a sense, is that the water represents the H2O, which is the saving of the physical, the material, how we cleanse the water, the environmental protection, the environmental sciences. And we need that ecology. We actually need to be cleaning the pollution and stopping pollutants going in. But the wave, that's the depth dimension. That's the cosmotheandric. And we can't just have the environmental cleanup if we don't also have the conversion to see that it's much more than just H2O stuff, materiality. I don't think I need to say much more, because I think maybe we want to go and have lunch, is that right? Okay, but thank you very much again for having me here, and I... That's it.